Welcome to the very first episode of the Free Radical Biology and Medicine podcast. Today we will discuss a special issue entitled Mitochondrial Redox Signaling in Aging-Related Diseases that was published in the November 2022 issue of the journal. Joining us are Dr. Thomas Michel and Dr. Doug Wallace. Professor Michel, over to you.
Welcome to our Free Radical Biology and Medicine podcast. I am Thomas Michel, and I am a professor of medicine and biochemistry at Harvard Medical School and a cardiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Today, I have the great pleasure of hosting Professor Doug Wallace, who is the Michael and Charles Barnett Endowed Chair in Pediatric Mitochondrial Medicine and director of the Center for Mitochondrial and Epigenomic Medicine at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Professor Wallace has contributed significantly to our understanding of mitochondrial human genetics, a field that he himself founded in the 1980s. Over the years, Professor Wallace's work has profoundly impacted a broad range of scientific fields, from human evolution to neurodegenerative diseases, and of course, to redox biology and medicine. Professor Wallace has published over 500 papers and has an H-index of 126. That's really high. His papers have been cited 54,000 times. We look forward to learning more from Professor Wallace today. Doug, to set the tone and set the scene for our audience, and particular for our younger researchers, I'd appreciate if you would briefly review your research training, early career, and highlight in particular the mentors you've had along the way and the important collaborations that you've established.
Well, thank you, Thomas. I'd really like to go back a little earlier to my academic career and go back to sort of childhood. And I have always been interested in three fundamental questions. Who am I? Where did I come from? And why do I feel bad? And so those basic ideas have really been the primary framework on which my whole life has been based on trying to address those questions. So I was very fortunate to be able to go to Cornell as an undergraduate. I was a resident of state of New York, so I got a special price break, which made it possible to go there. And I studied genetics and development, but I also was very interested in the physical sciences and was quite interested in how not biology interacted with chemistry and physics and how those concepts fit together. One of the things that is very clear from the physical sciences is that the most important thing is energy. And so I, of course, left Cornell with the clear understanding that if we really wanted to understand things, we needed to understand how energy flowed through those systems. After spending 2 years in the service, I then went to Yale. And there I had the privilege of being in the departments of microbiology and human genetics. That was a great place because Leon Rosenberg, who was then the chair of medicine, had developed a new department, the Department of Human Genetics. And his concept was that future biomedical discoveries would be due to collaborations between physicians and researchers. He organized the medical education to involve a thesis for every medical student and all of the PhD students to not only do their thesis, but to attend medical school classes so that we were conversant and had similar and overlapping conceptual frameworks. And I think that has really been was a very powerful model and has been very important in my life because it then set me on the stage to look at the questions of who am I and why do I feel bad. So then I moved on from Yale. I graduated from Yale after studying with Ed Adelberg, Jerome Eisenstadt, but most importantly with Harold Morowitz. And Harold Morowitz was a physicist. He published a great book called Energy for Biologists. And we spent one day a week doing philosophy of energetics and biology. And Harold's basic idea of a university should be a professor, a student, and a tree, and thought that all of the rest was irrelevant, because if you didn't have good ideas, you couldn't really be doing very good work. So then after Yale, I went on to work at Stanford under Joshua Lederberg's department, and that was really great because Joshua was very supportive of the work I had been doing at Yale. And at Yale, because I was interested in human energy, I decided to work on the mitochondria, because even in 1970, it was clear that the mitochondria generated about 90% of the energy of the body, and it had just been discovered that the mitochondria had its own DNA. And I rationalized that if something had its own DNA, the DNA could mutate, and if it mutated, it could give disease. So somebody should study the mitochondrial DNA to see if that would generate energy diseases. Fortunately, that gamble proved to be right, but it wasn't clear for many years after that that I could say that that gamble was correct. But anyway, after Yale, went on to Stanford, and Josh Lederberg was very supportive of this idea of studying the mitochondria. And that was tremendous, because he then gave me the opportunity to continue to pursue my own ideas for my career. After Stanford, I went to then Emory, where I had the opportunity of doing clinical genetics, which is what I'd really been prepared for at Yale. And so the beautiful thing about Emory and the Southeast is that there are very, very large pedigrees, because people live there and do not move a lot. So almost immediately we had pedigrees that I could start looking for diseases that might be due to mitochondrial DNA mutations. And of course, as you'll see later, those diseases would have a unique inheritance pattern, maternal inheritance. And so we had already been studying a disease called Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy. And when I visited Emory, I was taken by Skip Elsis to the clinic, and Skip brought me up to a little kiosk where there was a gentleman selling candy. And Skip said, "Do you want anything from the kiosk?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. I guess I'll have some candy." So the gentleman said, "Well, that'll be 25%, and stuck out his hand. And I gave him a quarter, and Skip said, "That is the proband from the largest Leber's pedigree that we have." So that immediately sold me on going to Emory. And then as we were moving to Emory, I really thought I was indestructible. So I was moving my lab in, my ultracentrifuges, moving all kinds of heavy equipment. And one day I was trying to move a big cabinet, and it started rolling down an incline, and I whipped around to hold it, and I snapped something in my back. And I ended up with a completely ruptured disc in my back. And my wife was driving me to my new job on the back of our station wagon and putting me on a gurney to do our research. And so then I was wheeled up to a neurologist to have my back looked at. And I was lying on the gurney in his office while he was doing something else. And I looked up on the wall, and there was this diagram of pedigree saying, X-linked myoclonic epilepsy. And I looked at that pedigree and I said, "That is not X-linked, that is maternal." And when the guy walked in, I said, "That pedigree is misclassified. That's a maternal pedigree of myoclonic epilepsy," which turned out to be also true. So that just indicates that there were really a wonderful opportunity to do clinical genetics in the Southeast. But then later I got an opportunity to go ahead to University of California, Irvine. There, I worked with Jay Gargas, Francesco Ayala, Frank Ralph Klayman, and others. And there, we took the mitochondrial medicine program that I had initiated at Emory, and we expanded it with more of a state of California emphasis, and really developed then a very great integrated clinical diagnostics and research program. And from there, I came to give a seminar at CHOP, and Marnie Falk and Mark Yudkoff and Steve Valschuler, Phil Johnson, and Tom Curran were there. And they said, "Well, why don't you come and do mitochondrial medicine at CHOP?" And so I decided to change, and that's where I am now. So that's how this all evolved.
That's great. It sounds like there's been a lot of consistency in your path in terms of following an interest. Yet When you found your way into these mitochondrial diseases, you're going up against the orthodoxy of strictly Mendelian genetics, looking at maternal inheritance. Really was at that time and continues to be, I think, a topic of great interest. What was it like coming into this field with your background, with your broad background, and bringing this concept of maternal inheritance of mitochondrial disease states into a world that was focused on Mendelian genetics?
Well, thank you, Thomas. That's a good question. Let me start by saying how we got into this maternal inheritance business in the first place. So, while at Yale, as I said, I got interested in the mitochondrial DNA, and that was very early on in the era of molecular biology. In fact, there was no molecular biology at that time in the early 70s. But we could isolate the mitochondrial DNA, and the person down the hall had just isolated RNA polymerase from E. coli. So I said to him, why don't we mix your RNA polymerase with my mitochondrial DNA and put in some P32 ATP and see if we can make some mitochondrial DNA RNA. So we did, not very efficiently, but we did make some mitochondrial RNA that was radioactive. And then later, sorry. At Stanford, we got a preprint from a guy named Southern out of Scotland. It had this very complex system by which you took Wattman paper and you made a diazotized alteration so that it would bind DNA. And then you could run a gel and transfer the DNA fragments on a gel onto this diazotized paper. And just at that time, restriction endonucleases had been just awarded the Nobel Prize. So we had a restriction endonuclease. So I had been interacting with a number of pedigrees around the faculty and then took, with their permission, DNA sample, blood samples, digested them with restriction enzyme, ran them on the gel, put them on diazotized paper, hybridized with my radioactive RNA. And lo and behold, we found that the mitochondrial DNAs, because it was a mitochondrial DNA probe, of all the children was identical to the mother. So that was in 1980, and that's when we then had the maternal inheritance to look for pedigrees that might be due to mitochondrial DNA mutations. But we have to also digress that while I was working at Yale, working on mitochondrial DNA genetics, I developed several ideas about how mitochondrial DNA actually worked in cells. There are thousands of copies within a cell, so you can have a mixture of mutant and normal mitochondrial DNAs called heteroplasmy. So we were also concerned that maybe you would get a pedigree with maternal inheritance of a heteroplasmic mutation, and you would have variable then expression of the phenotype. And so that meant that even though we didn't see absolute maternal inheritance on any one pedigree, we could rationalize that there would be variable expression along the maternal line, and that that then allowed us to find pedigrees that would in fact turn out to be maternally inherited. So anyway, that idea then was really only published in 1980, so it's pretty recent. And many of the clinical diseases before that that showed a transmission from the mother to boys would have been called X-linked inheritance. That's classic Mendelian. And so almost all of the mitochondrial diseases had been assumed to be X-linked. So it really took until 1988 when we could actually publish the mutations for Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy and for myoclonic epilepsy and Ragged-Red fiber disease, the one that I saw on the wall while I had my back examined, that they actually were due to point mutations in the mitochondrial DNA. The first one, the Leber's mutation, was had variable expression, but that was due to the fact that mitochondrial DNA copy number can also change, and those individuals with high mitochondrial DNA copy number had less expression than those people with low. So that was one variability. But the myoclonic epilepsy and ragged red fiber disease, that had high variability because of its heteroplasmy. So You can imagine that it was very difficult to get those papers published. It took almost a year of arguing with science to get the first Labor's paper published. And the question then is, well, why wouldn't that be obvious? And from my perspective, I think there's been basically two issues. The first is goes back to a guy named Vesalius that worked in Padua 500 years ago, and he defined the anatomy of the human body. And that was so innovative that all subsequent physicians are trained basically from an anatomical perspective. And that has led to many of our clinical subspecialties being anatomical, like cardiologists, for instance, Thomas, or ophthalmologists or neurologists or nephrologists. But there's sort of an unstated corollary there, and that is if you have a symptom in an organ, then the assumption is there's something wrong with that organ. And I call that the anatomical paradigm of disease. And the other, as Thomas, you mentioned, Mendel, about 150 years ago, studied pea plants, and a small percentage of the inheritance patterns he found in pea plants followed the pattern that he assumed there were two copies of each, what we now call a gene, each individual. And then one copy went into each gamete. And then in the next generation, the two copies came together. And that led to Mendelian genetics, which then turned out to explain very beautifully the inheritance pattern of the anatomical changes of Drosophila in the early 20th century. So the Drosophila geneticists then really validated Mendelian genetics as important. But they went on to assume that if something Mendelizes, it's genetics, but if it doesn't, it's environmental. And that then was another problem, because both the anatomical and Mendelian paradigms are limiting. It's entirely possible to have a systemic defect that has a tissue-specific symptom, and it's very possible to have a maternally inherited mitochondrial DNA mutation that does not Mendelize. And therefore, since mitochondrial energy genes turn out to be in the mitochondrial DNA, almost all of the genetics of energy metabolism has been basically overlooked. And so I believe right now our future really is to amalgamate the idea of anatomy plus energy plus information. That's what we require for life. But we have to give equal study to both the effects of energy defects as well as anatomical defects if we want to understand common disease. And I'm still arguing that point, but it's still a hard road to move forward on.
Well, it sounds like you've taken something that started off as a heretical observation, and now it's very much in the mainstream. Certainly, I know many colleagues, both here in Boston and elsewhere, whose fascination with mitochondria and whose focus on energy has animated many careers. As you look back over your career now, spending many decades, can you highlight just, you know, one or two or three that were your most exciting wow moments, where you just had a moment of insight, you know, the eureka moment, but let's call it wow, to use a more modern phraseology, that was surprising to you and you felt was potentially transformative, based upon something that was not known before that was discovered as a consequence of your efforts and the efforts of your lab?
Yes, thanks, Thomas. So probably the first was the development of a system to ask the question, is a mouse or a human cell line that is resistant to a drug called chloramphenicol due to a mutation in the mitochondrial DNA? Now, chloramphenicol is a very potent bacterial ribosome inhibitor, but the mitochondria is unique, and not only does it have its own DNA, but it's transcribed into RNA, and the RNA is translated on mitochondrial ribosomes. And the mitochondrial ribosomes are bacteria-like in that they're sensitive to chloramphenicol. So if you put a cell in chloramphenicol, it will eventually die, not because it affects the nuclear cytosol, but because it basically kills the symbiotic bacteria in our cells called the mitochondria. So we first were able to make cell lines that were resistant to chloramphenicol. But then the question is, was that chloramphenicol resistance due to a nuclear mutation, which everybody would have assumed, or due to a mitochondrial DNA mutation? So the system we developed was to take the chloramphenicol resistant cell and then put it into cytochalasin B, which disaggregates the cell cytoskeleton, and then put it into a density gradient, and the very dense nucleus can be pulled right out of the cell. So now you have a cytoplasmic fragment with its mitochondria and mitochondrial DNA, and you can fuse that to another cell that's chloramphenicol sensitive, and then we selected for chloramphenicol. And of course, if it was sent cytoplasmic without the nucleus, it would have to be transmitted through the cytoplasm. So the first big event was that indeed the cytoplasm transmitted chloramphenicol resistance. And that was the first time that anybody had shown that the mitochondrial DNA could actually code for inheritable information. So that I don't know that wow is the right word, but gratification was certainly true. The next major change event was developing the system for finding maternal inheritance of the mitochondrial DNA. That wasn't as surprising as one might think, because it's already been known that there was maternal inheritance in plants and also some evidence of maternal inheritance in animals. So though we needed to know whether it was true in humans, that probably wasn't as shocking as we might have expected. But with that same system of the mitochondrial DNA probe, restriction enzymes, and the proto-southern blots, we did that same year digested with that restriction enzyme samples from Europe, Africa, and Asia, and then put those on a gel and did the southern blot. And then we saw that every one of the continents had a different pattern of mitochondrial DNA variation. And so we had almost within 2 months of each other, the maternal inheritance and the continent variation of mitochondrial DNA. And it followed logically then that we could reconstruct the origin of women by simply following the mitochondrial DNA mutational path as women migrated around the world. So that was a wow, because we did not expect to find such a dramatic difference in different populations in the mitochondrial DNA. And I guess the last point is the realization of how much interesting biology there is in genetics when you look at point mutations in the mitochondrial DNA being modified by heteroplasmy, by mitochondrial copy number, by environmental influences, and by gender, all very interesting and still very exciting to study.
Thank you very much for that very exciting description of your wow moments over the years. There have been other wow moments that others have experienced. And I'm thinking of all of the new technologies that have emerged in the years in which you have been engaged personally in discovery. You mentioned your experience reading Dr. Southern's paper and doing what might have been one of the first Southern blots outside of Professor Southern's lab back in the day. And of course, there have been many other transformative technologies, thinking specifically about the Human Genome Project, and then subsequently with next-gen sequencing, that have really transformed our ability to assess genetic material on an individual basis. Perhaps you can reflect a little bit about how these new technologies have influenced your work and the pace of discovery in your field.
Thanks, Thomas. I think that's a really great question and interesting area to think about, because I went to Cornell from 1964 to 1968. And at that time, the course that we could take, an advanced course, was called microbial genetics. And that was then the forerunner of molecular biology, where they were using phage to isolate mutants and figuring out that it took three nucleotides to make a codon, that things were inherited in specific ways. And I remember the lecture that we had at 1968, where they showed a gel, thallium bromide stained gel of RNA, and there were two very big bands. And the professor said, "I don't see how you can get all the information of the genome in two bands," not realizing, of course, that those were ribosomal RNAs and that all the messenger RNAs were in the background. So that just shows in the 50 or 60 years since the original Watson and Crick paper, which is within my lifetime, how much has changed. So I would say that from a molecular point of view, the development of restriction enzymes was a big change because that gave us molecular markers. The isolation of E. coli DNA and RNA polymerase, which allowed us to make to isolate DNA and to make labeled probes. When we had the southern blot, which I mentioned, but when we found the original mutation for Leber's, which is in the mitochondrial DNA point mutation, we had about 25 pedigrees that I had collected by asking people around the world who published papers on Leber's to send a blood sample. And we wanted to test whether our particular mutation was found in all of those different pedigrees, because that would prove that it was, in fact, the real mutation. So at that point, we also had a preprint of something called PCR. And so we thought, well, what we could do is we could use PCR to amplify this portion of the mitochondrial DNA. And we had a restriction enzyme that would cut at the site that we had found. And so we were actually taking Eppendorf tubes with DNA and putting them in a hot bath, a cold bath, a hot bath, cold bath with stopwatch to do a PCR. So that was long before there were cycling instruments. My colleague, Marie Lott, literally became almost brain dead by doing 25 different pedigrees by hand, one water bath at the next. So that was an example. We also did really started sequencing the mitochondrial DNA just when maximum Gilbert and sequencing was became available. That was by chemical cleavage of the mitochondrial DNA, and we had to build our own sequencing apparatuses. So we'd make big glass gels on plates, and we'd clamp on a bath on the top and a bath on the top bottom with completely open to run the gels to make it hot enough to denature the DNA at thousands of volts with no protection at all, just sitting on the lab bench with all these buffers. So been lots of interesting experiences as we've applied these new techniques long before there was any commercial, a safe way of doing it. So we've had lots of fun, but some interesting experiences.
How things have changed. There's a kit for that now. So I'd like to switch gears a little bit and talk about some of the social implications of your work and broaden the discussion into science and society. Your work has certainly provided important new insights into the central importance of evolution in human disease. Yet there are a lot of individuals out there who don't believe in evolution, and they're deeply suspicious of science in general. What can we do as scientists to engage and educate those who are deeply mistrustful of science and scientists?
Well, I think that's a really important social responsibility of all of us in science. But I think the message we need to provide is that without our understanding about how genes change, we can't understand how genetic disease occurs. We can't then understand the causes of genetic disease. And more importantly, we cannot then develop therapies for them. And I think it's that immediate application of evolutionary theory that's made all of modern human genetics possible. The only problem is that these ideas are pretty complicated in the sense for if you're not initiated in some of the basic ideas, it's hard for you to really get this overall concept. So I think one of the real challenges is we need to have organizations like this blog, but other publications and social media that addresses the portion of the population that otherwise wouldn't have had the opportunity to get this background information. But then we need very creative people that can make these concepts straightforward and simple, so that they can see how their application has had such a huge benefit for health. And I think one of the best examples right now is work we're doing on SARS-CoV-2 and the fact that this virus is rapidly evolving and then rendering itself resistant to the different kinds of immunotherapy that we're using. And that's a classic example of how evolution is very important in human health. And I think if we could give examples of that idea to people to help them understand why the NIH makes some of the statements that it does and the CDC, that they would see that the statements that are made are not seemingly random, but really are based on some pretty fundamental ideas in evolution. So I think really communication will be critical.
Great. Well, thank you for mentioning communication because it leads into my next question. Your work over the years has really been based in fundamental genetics, yet your discoveries have very important implications for the field of redox biology and medicine. In fact, that aspect of your work has led to your invitation to participate in this broadcast for FRBM. What strategies have you used to communicate your work from one scientific field to another?
Well, I think it's really interesting to talk then about redox biology. There are really two systems that are very important in redox biology, as we now understand. One that you work on, which is the NOX system, which is an NADPH oxidase on the plasma membrane. But the other is the mitochondria. And the mitochondria generates reactive oxygen species. These are molecules made of oxygen that have an unpaired electron. And that unpaired electron wants another electron in its outer orbital, and it therefore acts as an oxidizing agent. So the mitochondria then is constantly making these reactive oxygen species, so-called oxygen radicals in the general literature. And those then turn out to be very important in affecting the biology of the cell. For example, in the mitochondrial DNA, the reactive oxygen species actually damage the mitochondrial DNA polymerase, and the mitochondrial DNA polymerase then becomes error prone, and it makes large numbers of mutations in the mitochondrial DNA. So that, we believe, then results in the accumulation of mitochondrial DNA damage in our cells and tissues. And since the mitochondrial DNA codes for the key enzymes or proteins of energy metabolism, in a sense, it's the wiring diagram of the power plant. The more mitochondrial mutants you have, the less power plants in your cell that are functional and the less energy any one organ has. And so you then get a energetic decline, the equivalent of a metropolitan brownout. And that in turn then will cross the expression threshold of an organ and give a phenotype. For instance, your brain is 2% of your body weight, but uses 20% of all your mitochondrial energy. So subtle changes in mitochondria are going to give you neurological diseases or heart diseases, example. So understanding redox biology and ROS in the mitochondria was critical to developing our biology and our therapy. So we created a number of years ago an enzyme catalase that's normally in peroxisome and put it into the mitochondria in a mouse. And we could have the mitochondrial DNA damage and increase the lifespan of that mouse by about 30%. So that shows that these somatic mutations in the mitochondrial DNA due to reactive oxygen species damage is in fact the aging clock. And so we're very actively developing therapeutics to control mitochondrial ROS production, protect the mitochondrial DNA, and delay the onset of age-related diseases. So certainly redox biology is very important in our lab.
Well, that's mentioning of age brings me to my penultimate question, which is, what advice do you have for young people who are interested in pursuing basic science as a career and dreaming of being eventually a leading scientist like yourself?
I never set out to be a leading scientist. I set out to answer three questions: who am I, where did I come from, and why do I feel bad? And that really is my only advice that I ever give to a young person, which is you should do what you're passionate about. Don't do what an authority tells you you should do, but find the things that really are meaningful to you and pursue them as hard as you can. And that will be, I think, the best road to happiness and to success. I think the thing that I see often very sad is that people come to advanced degree school, say medical school, with an idea of what somebody else thinks a doctor does, when in fact, and unless you really want to do medicine, it can be a difficult career. And I really think you should choose what's best for you and do it the best way you can.
Wonderful advice. I agree fully. So I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to participate in this podcast. I also want to thank our audience for listening in on FRBM. The podcast will be posted on both on the homepage and social media. And Doug, we look forward to our future interactions with you. Do you have any closing remarks to share with us?
Getting back to what we just said about careers, the important thing, as I said, is to follow your dream and that which you're passionate about. And then you'll discover very interesting things that at some point you may not have expected. For example, it was my educations at Yale and my studies on mitochondria that led me to realize that the paradigms we're currently using in medicine might be limiting in our ability to understand common diseases. Remember, that's the anatomical paradigm of disease and the Mendelian paradigm of genetics. And I think if we then expand those ideas to now include the energetic paradigm of disease and the non-Mendelian paradigm of genetics, we can get a more coherent and holistic view of the disease process. And that will then, I believe, allow us to address the common diseases like diabetes, obesity, macular degeneration, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease, cardiomyopathy, because those are the diseases that the previous paradigms have struggled so hard to address and have had real difficulty making progress. So I think that if we keep an open mind and we do what we're excited about, we'll get new insights on things that we don't know, but we should know. And that ultimately will allow us to move forward for the betterment of people. So I really want to thank you, Thomas, and the organizers of this podcast for letting me have a chance to visit with our listeners and with you.
I just want to thank you, Doug, for sharing your science and for sharing your wisdom, and look forward to our future interactions. I think that concludes today's broadcast. I want to thank everyone for their attention and wish everyone all the best.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Free Radical Biology and Medicine podcast. Please feel free to share this episode with your friends and colleagues, and check out our other articles and podcast episodes on the FRBM website.